Welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm Larry Kamer. The Deep Dive is an in-depth discussion of some of the most important issues facing us here in the Napa Valley and in wine country. On our program, we try and bring you insights, information, and guests that you may not hear anywhere else. We originate from the studios of KVON in beautiful Napa, California. Our new programs air every Thursday morning at 9 o'clock, and you can always listen to our past programs at the website kvon.com. I'm always happy to hear from you and especially welcome your suggestions for future discussions and possible guests. Please email us, deepdiveshow at winedownmedia, W-I-N-E, winedownmedia.com. We're on Twitter and Instagram at deepdiveshow, and I invite you to like our Facebook page, Deep Dive Show. If you're interested in some of our past conversations, you can find them all on kvon.com. I would especially encourage you to listen to last week's discussion with our district attorney, Allison Haley, here of Napa County. You can hear that and all of our previous interviews at kvon.com. Today I'm talking with Rob McMillan, the EVP and founder of the Silicon Valley Bank Wine Division. It goes without saying that all of us who live in this valley are in one way or another heavily dependent on the success of the wine industry. We tend to think about wine at so many different levels. We think about it in very lofty ways. People talk about it being integral to the human spirit. We talk about the delight it brings people, the catalyst for great conversations or great deals or great love affairs. And I do really think, I do really think that some of that intangible, mysterious quality of wine really does inspire a lot of the people I've met in the wine world. Producing grapes and wine is, of course, an art and a science. Some of the viticulturists and vineyard manager and field workers that I've met are incredibly technically competent at what they do. But ultimately, and this is the subject of our discussion today, it's a business. And in 2020, this business has a lot to be concerned about. The budgets of baby boomers as we crossed the retirement line, the tastes of millennials and Gen Zers who may be much more inclined to order a craft beer or a cocktail over a glass of wine or a bottle of wine, the popularity of alcohol-infused sodas and other drinks. I've yet to have a White Claw, but I see them all over the place. And the enormous potential for competition and maybe even synergy at some point with the cannabis industry. So Rob's report is called The State of the U.S. Wine Industry 2020. It's one of the more interesting things I've read in a long time. And I spent a lot of time poring over his arguments, his statistics, and his graphs. I am still channeling my inner school grad student, I think. And that was a long time ago. So off the top, I want to just talk about a couple of quick things before we get to our conversation with Rob. We are going to the polls again on Tuesday, this coming Tuesday, also known as Super Tuesday, where voters in 14 states are going to choose a huge number of the delegates who will ultimately nominate the Democratic nominee. I'm not forgetting about you Republicans, but that contest is pretty much a foregone conclusion. My pitch to you today is do not ever take your right to vote or the importance of your vote for granted, even if you are voting on the losing side. Here's why. Around the time I was born, people were still being killed to protect the right to vote for certain portions of our population, most especially African Americans. We tend to think of civil rights protests in the South, but voter intimidation was rampant all over the country. And when intimidation didn't work, voters were made to take so-called poll tests. And if this seems like a ridiculous idea to you today, remember this was not all that long ago. You were forced to answer questions that were designed to confuse you in order to exercise your right to vote. One of those questions was, spell backwards, forwards. Another one was print the word vote upside down, but in correct order. You're given 10 minutes to do this, and if you didn't make a perfect score, you're not allowed to go in and vote. This is your constitutional right as an American citizen. Not only is it denied to you, but for good measure, you're made to feel small and like an idiot in front of your neighbors. Now, from my perspective, I vote because I'm tired of pundits, Twitter trolls, Russian hackers, bots, and others who presume to represent my point of view or to speak for me. And pundits whose outright predictions are often wrong, made without any factual basis, and without any consequence. I mean, most of us, if we make a prediction and we're wrong, we have to pay a price for it. I know my guest does, if he's wrong in his in some of his predictions, and I know I am too with my clients. So it's only February. The general election is more than 8 months away, but I really kind of want all these people to shut up right now. So think of voting as one way to get your opinion out there and to get them to stop talking. I also vote because I have seen literally how my vote makes a difference. When I was in college, I worked very hard for my local congressman. And even though that was a long time ago, it is still in my mind as some of the most rewarding work I've ever done. And we flipped a congressional district from red to blue. We had more than 213,000 people come out and vote in that election in 1976, and my guy won by 201 votes. I knew that, like the other people who were cheering our victory that election night, my vote and the votes of the people that I influenced to go to the polls made up those 201 votes that made that victory possible. Think about this, too. Voter turnout is 2 to 3 times higher among people over age 65 than among people aged 18 to 24. Senator Sanders talks about a revolution that's going to result in massive voter turnout and massive voter turnout among young people. I really do hope that happens, but remember that older voters vote at a rate 3 times higher. Voter turnout is also double among wealthy people compared to poor people, and about double with those who have graduate degrees compared to those with a high school diploma. Now, when I lived in Chicago, we used to joke that you should go out and vote early and often. All I'm asking you to do today is to vote twice. Next Tuesday, March 3rd, and then again on Tuesday, November 3rd. So on today's program, I'm talking with Rob McMillan, the author of The State of the Wine Industry 2020. Rob, I really want to thank you for joining me on the show today.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having
me. I imagine, Rob, that you did not just fall to earth as a wine business expert. I'm interested in a little bit about your background and how you got here.
Well, I grew up in Concord, East Bay, and back in the day, we were in a marching group called the Blue Devils, and we marched in parades, and my parents would drag us up here for the Napa parade, and there's also a Calistoga parade, and they would stay at both a park, and they would do tastings back in the 60s, and that's when it was free, So I had always had an interest in it from that standpoint, and my older brother used to tell me that if I didn't stop whining, they were going to send me to the winery.
Winery.
So that was another point. And then when I graduated from Sac State, my first assignment was as an ag lender in Lakeport, which was not a great place to be for a single young male, but that's where I was, and my first account was to a small winery up and coming by the name of Chateau du Lac, which was later renamed Kendall Jackson and now Jackson Family Wine. So for some reason, wine just has continued to cross my path, whether I wanted it to do that or not.
Right. And the origin of the Silicon Valley Bank wine division, these are not two kind of concepts that I think a lot of people put together in their head, Silicon Valley and wine. How did that business come about?
Well, yeah, and actually, when I first came up to Napa, we started the practice in 1994. First coming up here, that's the same question we got all the time. I understand the wine industry in Napa, and I understand the technology industry in Silicon Valley. But how does wine work in the Silicon Valley? What ended up happening way back when in the early 90s is we decided we were going to go look at specific businesses that other banks shied from. And so the wine industry, as people maybe have a hard time remembering, wasn't so successful in the late 80s and into the early 90s. But I noticed when I was doing my research that there was this small turn. And though we were seeing declines in volumes back then, underneath it, there was this premium category that seemed to be trending up, and I thought that was tied to boomers. And so I made the argument that that would be a good business to get into. Other banks weren't in it. As a matter of fact, the other banks when we started that were doing it thought they had too much market share, and they were our best referral sources. So it ended up at first kind of being difficult for people to understand, but since there were really no banks that were aggressively prosecuting the business was flying in the door. So
they didn't care that you were a Silicon Valley bank.
They got over it pretty fast.
My favorite kind of Silicon Valley and wine story is a friend of mine bought a place in Woodside, and he's quite a successful guy, and he put in grapes. You know, like everybody else, he wanted to be a farmer, and he put in grapes. And one day I was at his house and I said, "How's that going?" And he said, "Well, let me pour you a glass." He said, "It'll be the most expensive wine you've ever had in your life by the price of what this glass cost." So in the report, The State of the Wine Industry, you attempt to balance out the good news with some of the more ominous stuff that you see on the horizon. So, but to my kind of non-expert eyes reading it, the net of the report struck me as cautionary, maybe even negative. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah. People last year, actually, when I said we were in a point of oversupply and declining consumer demand on a volume basis, everybody said that I was just a doom and gloomer. I said that last year, and that's in January. And by the end of the year, it was pretty clear we had oversupply. And what I noticed is, again, as a trend accelerated. There's only one analyst now at this point that actually thinks we have positive volume growth as an industry. Positive, negative, I just have a tendency to look at things the way they are and say what I believe. I'm not, fortunately, I work for an organization that doesn't really censure me that much.
Or play favorites.
They kind of let me say what I believe. And so I think I've gained a reputation as being mostly honest as much as I can be. So the industry has got some major issues ahead. The trends are not moving in the right direction. It's not all, you know, it's not all doom and gloom, really. The fine wine industry, the Napa Valley in particular, is probably growing around 5% on a dollar basis, more flat on a volume basis. So it's not, you know, it's not like it's terrible, but the trends are consistent year over year over year over year now for the last five. And, you know, if you don't arrest a trend, if you don't do something to arrest a trend, then more than likely that trend will continue. And so that's where I spend most of my time now, is to talk about, you know, A, what's happening. Hopefully we have people that are recognizing now and accepting the issues and challenges that we have as an industry. And then after that, I start to talk about things we can do to improve the situation.
Yeah, which I really am interested in getting into. I want to start kind of at the basics, though. You know, planted acres, price of grapes, availability of juice. Draw us a picture of where we are here in the Napa Valley and maybe relative to other regions.
Napa Valley is one of the top AVAs, appellations, in the world. And to the extent that the Napa Valley has that kind of notoriety, there is some level of insulation from general economic trends, simply because, you know, you're selling very expensive wines in large part to more wealthy people. You know, the Napa Valley is at that pinnacle. You know, that said, this last year, and it's happened before, but this last year we had grapes that weren't picked. Hard to say how much. We have a grape crush report that comes out, and just Cabernet was off about 20% from last year.
From the actual amount of grapes that were picked.
From the actual amount of grapes that were picked, right. And so, you know, it's hard to compare it because you don't really know, you know, true yields, and what didn't get picked doesn't show up in the grape crush report. So, but, you know, it's obvious that there was somewhere between 10 and the high side, 20% not picked. It's also backed up into the bulk wine category. But, you know, the Napa Valley makes great wine. And so,
yeah, I've noticed
we'll see that bulk wine get pulled out here pretty quick, and it already is, and it'll go into lower priced goods, and we'll clear the channel.
You said, though, that speaking of the oversupply, you cite oversupply at like every single stage of the supply chain,
yeah,
all the way from the field through retail. And you call this the worst combination of market conditions since 2001 and perhaps all time.
Yep.
Why do you come to that conclusion?
Well, the issue is declining consumer demand. And so in the past 30-plus years, you know, you have to go back to 93 to see the last time that we actually had volume declines. And so that
you're talking about gross volume declines,
gross volume,
overall volume
declines. Yeah, and not Napa particular, but the industry as a whole. So you got to go back a very long way, and you have to, you know, think about what was going on back then. That was mothers against drunk driving. That was lowering of the blood alcohol limit, drunk driving. A lot of things were happening back then that was driving down volume. It was also coming off an era where we had wine coolers, and the boomers were drinking a lot of wine coolers. That all kind of, that faddish thing kind of came to an end at that same point. But the premium side, like I said earlier, had some demand growth underneath it. So we see what we do now with this rotation of consumers off of the boomers into the younger consumer. And the younger consumer doesn't have the same affluence. And they never do, by the way. You know, you start off young. You know, boomers didn't have affluence either.
Question is, will these my kids, the millennials, you know, will the economics allow them to get to, you know, to par with where their parents were?
Yeah.
And there's a real question.
There's a question. But just looking at it from a current state, there's two questions. Is if they had the money, would they buy wine?
Yeah.
And
when I was 30, no.
No. You know, I mean, well, you know, when I was 18, 19 or whatever it was, I would, you know, steal from my dad's jug underneath the counter next to the garbage disposal in perfect storage conditions and fill it back up with water. So
just be sure you were drinking wine and not like, you know, cleanser or something.
Yeah.
Like that.
So, I think when you're young and you're going through your experience, you know, stage where you're just saying, you know, do you like spirits? Do you like wine? Do you like beer? I think everybody kind of goes through that, and price plays a large role in that. As you start to work through your career, you evolve. Most people believe that that's a normative process, that that's what everybody does. But, you know, once again, I think people have blinders on because we have 30 years of growth because of the boomers, because the boomers moved to premium wine. But the circumstances aren't here now to see that same thing repeat. And people forget that back in 93, 94, we really didn't have craft spirits and we really didn't have craft beer. So if you wanted premium any alcohol, it was kind of wine. And so that's very different now. Today, the consumer doesn't really identify as a wine drinker, beer drinker, or spirits drinker. They're drinking across categories.
Mm-hmm.
So the competition isn't Paso Robles or Willamette Valley. The competition really is spirits. Spirits are seeing some very nice growth, and wine isn't. So,
and we'll get into some of the economics that give spirits a competitive advantage in just a sec.
That's right.
I you know, it's funny. I have a peculiar notch in kind of my timeline in that I grew up in the state of New Jersey, which, like many states in the 70s, dropped the drinking age to 18. And I think the theory at that time was, look, you're old enough to vote. You're old enough to fight and die for your country, because we were still in Vietnam.
That's right.
You're old enough to raise a family. You ought to be old enough to have a beer.
Or a tequila sunrise, in my case.
Well, and it was 18 for everything.
That's
in Jersey.
I'm saying tequila. That's from my first tequila sunrise.
Was in New Jersey?
Yeah.
So in high school, I was legal. Then I go to Chicago to go to college, where the drinking age is 21. So I'm legal in high school, but not legal in college. And to make it even more fun, I lived in Evanston, which was a dry town in the home of the Women's Christian Temperance Union. So getting a drink was a real labor. So I'm gonna give you another quote. You say retiring wine-loving baby boomers are now being replaced by more spirits-loving millennials, and now Gen Zers who consume less alcohol than prior generations. We need to attract those young consumers, but are doing a poor job of that.
Yeah,
that's pretty damning.
Well, yeah, our industry is traditional to start, and it's a family-based industry. Even Gallo, which is the largest winery in the world, is family-owned. So the smaller wineries make up the dominant number of wineries. Obviously, the top ones make up the volume that are selling less expensive wines. About the first 13 wineries by production size make up about 75% of total wine sales. So everybody else, it's pretty much everybody in the Napa Valley, has to look at things from a different perspective. And with all this growth we've had for so long, it gets really easy to keep doing what you did the day before. And I think probably one of the harder things to do in business, no matter where you are, is to AC trends that are coming in front of you, and then B, decide to make changes when things are going okay. It's really easy to make changes when things aren't going okay, because you go, well,
what have I got to lose?
What have I got to lose? Right. And the truth is we have a lot to lose unless we do make changes. So, just as an example, the older consumer, when we grew up, we wore our affluence on our sleeve. That was a measure of success. We wore our Jordache jeans, our Izod T-shirts. We probably wore a belt with some label on it, even, and Ray-Ban sunglasses, drove BMWs.
Big watch.
Yeah, we liked medals and trophies, and we liked that successful recognition. And that's really an anathema for the young consumer to look at that kind of
conspicuous
conspicuous consumption and financial success. They're not into that. And yet we've kind of grown this wine industry on lifestyles of the rich and famous.
It's interesting because just thinking about how I became interested in wine, it happened through work. It happened through work gatherings. When we moved here in the mid 80s, we didn't really know much about wine. We'd moved here from Chicago, which is, more of a beer town. Or as I like to call it, Chicago is a great drinking town with a sports problem. But we started going out with our colleagues, and we were in San Francisco, and all of a sudden, all this wine starts showing up, and it's pretty damn good.
It's good.
And my boss, knew his way around a bottle of wine, and so... So we had that experience, but I have to believe that changing work experiences probably changed that for people who are coming up in the work world as well.
Yeah. Well, you go back to the 90s and we had things like the French paradox,
yes.
60 Minutes Morally Safer comes out and says, I think Serge Renaud was the scientist and who said that, the French are having all these fatty diets, and yet they have lower incidence of coronary heart disease. And so
they eat all that butter and cheese, and they smoke cigarettes.
But they drink wine, that's what it was attributed to. And immediately after that, red wine sales just spiked.
Health food.
We had the Mediterranean diet that came out long before then, but it really became popular in that same period. And then another guy... Arthur, I think his name was Klatsky, identified the J-shaped curve, which showed that those that imbibed moderately of any alcohol had more successful health outcomes than those that even abstained. And then, of course, the other side, you can't deny the other side, which is, you know, drunk driving and abuse and all that stuff as well. But moderate consumption was viewed as being a healthy outcome. And that's not the case anymore. We've lost that argument, not so much because of the science, but because the industries have largely stopped talking about health and wine, or health and beer and health and spirits. It's the spirits producers are actually doing something along those lines, and that's probably some of our blueprint for change.
Yeah, I mean, I'm keen to talk to you about this on the other side of our break, being a kind of marketing communications person myself, and seeing how wine talks about itself, beer, spirits, cannabis, and, you know, in kind of a health and wellness context,
Yeah. And
what's being done to actually combat attacks that are still, you know, very real.
There is an anti-elk lobby and a movement, and it's well-funded. You know, the Bill Gates Foundation is a big contributor to that, but the World Health Organization has got their own agenda that contributes to it. And believe it or not all science is true. Some science is paid, and of course everybody's got their own bias.
And it pays to understand what science does and what it doesn't do.
Yeah, we have this belief that science is science, and if it's science, then it must be perfectly accurate. And science evolves over time to as a starting point. But, you know, when you see things such as came out this last year, that a study, quote unquote, that was done and funded, I think Bill Gates Foundation funded part of this, and it said that one bottle of wine a week is like smoking 10 cigarettes.
Oh, please.
And I mean, on the surface, it sounds pretty strange, but it gets a lot of press, and, you know, it's the cumulative effect of all of those kinds of statements that eventually lead a consumer to say, you know what, wine, it's not good for you. I mean, it's like smoking cigarettes. I'm going to have a White Claw.
Mm-hmm. I remember when Super Size Me came out, I was working, one of my clients was a big fast food chain, and, you know, their argument was, look, if you go into Starbucks and order, you know, triple caramel lattes and eat only that every day, you're going to look like this guy who ordered Big Macs and large fries and milkshakes. That, you know, at least some of these producers are trying to find you at all points on the spectrum. So if you want to go into McDonald's and get a salad, you can get a salad. I don't imagine most people go into McDonald's to get a salad, but it's important to them to offer that choice. And when we come back after the break, I want to talk to you about how the beverage industry is responding, because you have some interesting insights in your report as well. Talking with Rob McMillan of Silicon Valley Bank, I'm Larry Kamer, and this is The Deep Dive. Hi, and welcome back to The Deep Dive. I'm Larry Kamer. We're talking today with Rob McMillan, author of the State of the Wine Industry 2020 report. Rob is from the Silicon Valley Bank, and we've been talking about the effects of oversupply here in the Napa Valley. And we were most recently, before the break, talking about the changing tastes of wine and spirits drinkers. From people our age to people our kids' age, and what that means. Rob, I kind of want to go back and talk about myself here for just a second. So you say in your report that in the next 6 years, about 28 million Americans are going to cross into retirement, cross into the age 66. That's true in my case. And that 30 million people are going to turn 40. That's a lot of buying power to ignore. So talk about that.
Yeah, and the reality is we're already seeing the impact of an increasing number of, it's not a linear thing, there's more and more boomers every day that are crossing that 66. Every single year, there are more than the prior year for the next 9 or 10 years. So as you get closer to retirement, you change your spending patterns. You start to think about how much you really have, and you might even make relocation decisions if you haven't planned. And the overwhelming evidence suggests that most of the boomer generation hasn't done a great job of planning. So it's not out of the realm of reality to expect this generation that has been a credit generation, spending on credit, brought up on credit, pulling back and not
easy credit in a lot of cases. It's
very, and actually tax deductible. Retail credit back in the 80s was tax deductible. That's the way we were brought up. So, different generation now. Not only have they gone through the Great Recession, they got a late start on their careers and a lot of life events, but they don't believe in credit. They've seen the bad side of it. They're savers, which is obviously a good thing. I think they believe that they won't see Social Security for their own retirement, and so they're putting away money. And all those things, though, dampen retail. We're a retail economy, and all those things, whether you're a boomer that's becoming more frugal or you're a young consumer just starting out. And by the way, when we talk about millennials, they're 38, 39 now at the edge. So, they're not in footed pajamas eating Garanimal cereal anymore.
Maybe some of them are, but
I think on the other end it's 23 or 24. So,
right.
So that whole large generation is moving into their, spending years. They're starting to develop households, families, but they're more frugal spending people. So, we see the same thing across both generations. We have more frugal consumers today.
Well, and you talk about, I love this expression that you use in the report in the State of the Wine Industry 2020. You talk about millennials having an outlook of frugal hedonism.
Yeah.
Frugal hedonism.
Yeah.
Which means, among other things, they're put off by high restaurant prices for wine. How else does this frugal hedonism manifest itself?
Well, they know what good is, and with wine, they understand good wine largely. They're more access to better information than certainly their parents' generation. But they don't spend the same way. It's fairly common to see somebody shop for used clothing or repurposed goods.
Without the stigma.
Flea markets. Yeah, without the stigma from the boomer generation. If you shopped at Goodwill when you were a boomer, you felt like a real loser.
Right.
And today I watch the young consumers, they'll walk into Goodwill, they'll buy something, they'll put their own design or something on it. But they don't live their life that way. They're just more cautious about where they spend their money, and then they'll go buy $1,000 iPhone and an Apple Watch.
Mm-hmm.
So they're just more selective about the things that they spend their money on. Maybe not on cars. Maybe it's Uber instead.
But you say that this cohort, millennials, and I'm surrounded by millennials. I have two of them myself, and my wife and I have two of them, and I teach in graduate school, so I'm, and then I work with a lot of millennials in our business. But you say that this cohort has not really begun to embrace wine. And anecdotally, from what I see, that does seem to be the case. So what does the industry got to do to change that?
Well, that's where the sales and marketing has to change. We in the wine industry have grown up talking about long days and cool nights and pHs and harvest dates. You read the back of a label and it just sounds so glorious. It's got hints of graphite. I don't know that that's ever been glorious for me, but, graphite, cedar box, and Olala berry or something like
well,
that.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. I have to tell you a very, very funny story. Several years ago, my wife and I went up to Amador County to taste the wines up there, and I really enjoy the wines up there. And the tastings were all still free. And so we we hit a few wineries, and at the end of the day, we walked into this one winery, and I wish I could remember the name of it, but it was very old school. You know, you pulled into the dirt parking lot, chickens ran out of the way, these old saloon doors when you came in, and the guy starts pouring us the Zinfandel. And he says, folks, you know, it's the end of the day. I imagine you've all been out wine tasting. I imagine you've had wine that tastes like, you know, cocoa and cigar boxes and, you know, hints of blueberry and blah, blah, blah. He said, here, we make wine that tastes like wine, yeah. which I thought was so hilarious.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, the descriptors actually even tend toward stuffiness, which again, that young consumer is shunning.
Right.
So, when you look at the spirits category, as an example, Ketel One Vodka was not doing all that well, and then they put the word botanical in it. And when you read the front of a Ketel One vodka bottle now, it's, you know, botanicals with natural infusion botanicals. So the words that are used, they don't say it's good for you, but they use the words like sustainable. Another one that I saw, this is a caffeinated beverage, and it says 90 milligrams of natural caffeine.
Hmm.
I don't know what artificial caffeine is, but maybe there is some. But, you know, you see the spirits makers trying to leverage terms that are close to healthiness.
And, yeah, well, nothing new about that. I mean, even back in the 20s, you know, marketers were selling ivory because it was whiter than other white soaps.
Yeah.
It's the whitest white soap.
And good for your skin, too, I'm
sure. Yes, and it floats.
And it did float, that's right. So, you know, it's that, you look at what's happening with spirits, right? And spirits are growing, even though the consumer is consuming less alcohol than prior generations right now. And, you know, that's what we have to look at. We have to start talking about, here's the odd thing. Is I think what we have is a young consumer that doesn't know that wine is exactly the beverage that they're looking for. You know, if you're looking for something that's artisanal, that's craft, that is
organic,
natural,
right?
Or plant-based.
Wine. Try our plant-based wine.
Our plant-based wine, right? You know, there's nothing like wine. It's been around 10,000 years. Actually, I think a little bit more than that. I was over in the Republic of Georgia, and they have the earliest evidence. I think it was 14,000 years ago. You know, been around a very, very long time. It's better than it was 14,000 years ago, for sure. And
who can check, really?
We just got to stop talking about long days and cool nights and lifestyles of the rich and famous. We need to adopt this young consumer's values, and we need to start talking about the way that the wine is sustainable. We need to start talking about the carbon footprint of the things that we do. We have to start talking about the fact that it is, you know, maybe gluten-free, or there's no sugar or no added sugar for that matter.
Or low in carbs.
Or low in carbs, yeah. All the things that signify some sort of health. Now, I don't think we need to make a cartoon out of the front of our labels, because especially in the Napa Valley, you know, we have a luxury product. But the pushback that I get from producers right now are, well, that's not the way we present our goods. And my response is, well, keep presenting them the way you want them. Now, I think to a large extent, the very expensive wines of the Napa Valley are still sold to a large extent, almost exclusively to those boomer consumers. So they're not going to care if you are marketing to a young consumer. They're still happy that you're marketing in a way that they're familiar.
Right. That'll sell a $300 bottle of wine or a $1,000 bottle of wine.
But inevitably, we all have to make this adjustment, because this is a new consumer with different values. And I don't care what you're selling. You've got to adopt their values and the things that are important to them, because that's sales and marketing.
You talk in the report about something you call share of gullet, which I thought was a pretty interesting expression, just to talk about how wine and beer and spirits and maybe even cannabis do compete in a lot of the same ways, and then in a lot of same ways, they're appealing to very different people under very different circumstances. But the numbers you cite are really compelling. You say it costs $1.02 for a 12-ounce beer, 88 cents for a shot of whiskey or shot of booze, but $1.51 for a 5-ounce pour of wine. And you say it's easy to see why spirits and beer are winning over wine with young people just on price.
Well, it's they have an advantage with price. The spirits producers have an advantage on cost. They produce, all they have to do is turn the water on.
I just love this. Yeah, it's water and industrial ethanol. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
Isn't that a white claw?
Well, it is. It is kind of a white claw, which is, you know, again, once again, amazing that the young consumer believes that white claw spiked seltzers are actually more healthy for you than wine. And one of the main reasons is they actually post the fact that they have 100 calories on it. And I ask people all the time, how many calories do you think is in a bottle of wine? And even people in the industry, they all ask the same questions. They go, well, what size serving?
Try 5-ounce pour.
What are you talking, red or white? And then after you get through those introductory, they all say, well, it depends. Or they'll say, it adds about, 120, 50 calories. I don't know. And therein lies the problem. These young consumers look at calories as part of health. Mm-hmm. And, they've been trained by all the health folks that have pulled all of the vending machines out of all of the high schools and intermediate schools to make sure we weren't drinking sugared sodas. And so they're looking at calories. They've been trained to look at calories. And we don't put calories on wine bottles. That's a miss.
Glass of wine is how many calories? What should the answer be? What's the short answer?
Well, my short answer is there's about 750 per bottle, so that's my serving.
Okay. But even Coke talks about,
and that's red wine,
how a Coke is 150 calories a can. You know, they are not shy about even when the calories are high, advertising that because they may not be as high as you think they are.
Well, Coke is another great example about marketing because, as I mentioned, the pressure about sodas and diabetes that has been on them. And, you know, what they've done is they've taken their 12-ounce cans or 10-ounce cans, whatever they were before.
And pony cans.
And they've turned them into 7.5 ounces.
Right.
You know, again, the boomer generation, we thought, okay, we weren't going to pay for packaging. So we end up with these 3-liter bottles of soda. Now it's flipped on its head. The younger consumers want to know how many calories it is. So Coke just, well, just cut the size in half or whatever. So it's 7.5 ounces. And that category for Coke is flying off the shelf. The
right.
Little small cans.
Because,
it's lower calorie. And that's what
they
put.
Because you can't drink more than what's in the can, right?
That's what they say. It's lower calorie. Well, okay. It's lower calorie. It's marketing.
Well, it's, speaking as in defense of marketing, it's also the truth, right? But it's what they choose to put forward as kind of the first thing they punch a consumer with.
And,
right?
As a serving, the young consumer looks at that and, well, that's all I'm going to drink. I'd rather drink a smaller can. So, it plays to their values, and we don't do that.
One of the things that I'm always struck by is I just sense that most people who are in the store buying wine, up here it's probably very different, but one looks the same as the next. Like, I know I want a Chardonnay, but a nice label is going to draw me to that, or a nice price is going to draw me to that. Do you think that more information on the label would actually be helpful? Nutrition information or some of these other attributes, like plant-based or some of those things?
But the label's only a component of marketing and sales. There's when people are in shopping, they're going to make very quick decisions. So, one of the things that I'm encouraging the industry to do is to move away from these lengthy descriptions in the back of bottles and, start
inspired by generations of
start using, pithy statements, naturally farmed from sustainable vineyards, reduced carbon footprint, whatever, put them in bullet points instead of these long sentences.
Is anybody actually doing that?
There's a couple, and I have in my presentation one in particular that I found, but very few, and very few actually use calories as well. So, yeah, we have a long way to go.
You talk in your report, you know, you make this linkage between oversupply and the choices that vineyards and farmers have now to, on what to do with their land, given this oversupply of grapes, especially those who own their, who grow their own grapes. You know, we're well past the days where fruits and nuts and cattle are going to be a big alternative, a sustainable alternative in the Napa Valley.
Yeah.
Which brings the question of cannabis to mind. Now, for the proponents, the economics of cannabis are pretty compelling. You can harvest it more than once a year, which is more than you can say about grapes. The cash value per acre is very high. And yet here in Napa, we're taking a deliberate, go-slow approach on commercial cultivation. And the reasons that the County Board of Supervisors and others cite have to do with compatibility of growing with wine, impact on neighboring grape cultivation, water use, crime. But we look at places like Sonoma County, Santa Barbara County, where they're moving much more aggressively. These are wine-influenced places, moving much more aggressively into cannabis. Do you think Napa is missing an opportunity?
No. And the reason I don't is that I've watched what's happened in Washington and Oregon and some of the laws that were passed there to try to encourage small farmers. And what ended up happening is Oregon and Washington overproduced for their state. And you just can't take your production and sell it out of state.
That's overproduced cannabis.
Cannabis, right. Yeah. You can't take that production and sell it out of state. That's illegal. You can't move it out of state. And California's got the same issue, is that we already produce more than we need. And so, you know, naturally it's being exported elsewhere. And it's not going particularly through legal channels.
Right.
You know, the arguments for cannabis in terms of legalization, I'm all for. I don't have a problem with that, recreationally or otherwise. But, you know, where you grow it does make a difference. If you ask the folks down in Santa Barbara who now are dealing with substantially large plots of cannabis grows, not only is there an odor issue, but, you got fences, white fences with a serpentine wire across the top.
Right.
We still don't have a way to deposit cash. And it's not like the production in Santa Barbara is all going to Santa Barbara. It's going to be spread throughout the state. So the question for a Napa consumer is, does it need to be
produced
in Napa in order for you to have, you know, the right dosage for you or the, you know, whatever it is you want to use? You know, there's a lot of great places that already grow, you know, exceptional weed, you know, Mendocino County being one of them. If we want to have farms that brand themselves Napa cannabis, you know, the obvious reason that you do that is because you have somebody that thinks that they're going to lever off the Napa name.
And you don't think that's real?
Good business model, you know, if you can do it. But, you know, what value does that bring back the county? You know, so far the promises that you've seen from most of the cannabis legislation that's gone through has fallen short of expectation at this point. But I think we make enough. I think there's more than enough. I think we're going to have a sustainable culture. Then I think we probably should go slow on the notion of growing cannabis inside Napa.
Yeah, I mean, you make the argument that a lot of the proponents make, which is that there's a marketability to the Napa name or Napa destination to come and have that as part of your, you know, your wine country experience.
Yeah, it doesn't stop smoking weed and having, Sansomelian and salmon dinners. People can still do all of that. The only question is do you need to grow it here?
I can call Ease and have some delivered, you know, before we get off the show today, right?
Can you tell me how to do that?
It's not that hard.
I didn't know about that.
And the argument's made that 64% or over 60% of the people voted for legalization of marijuana in Napa County, that's true, but were they voting for local cultivation? And that's kind of where the rub is.
Yeah, I voted pro. Voted for legalization. I'm after watching the industry evolve here and seeing the problems that it has brought. I don't go to the other side and start talking about crime that much, but you know, my thing is it really needed? Is it sustainable? Is it the kind of thing that you really want? And my answer right now is I don't think so, but I'm open.
We are about to run out of time, and I want to ask you a question since we're on the subject of CBD. You talk about the prospect of CBD-infused spirits or CBD-infused beverages in your report. Is it a real threat to wine?
Not substantially yet, because you know, as it relates to wine today, you can't infuse wine with CBD. So that, as an alternative, that's not really a threat. But as we start to talk about the health components of other beverages, you know, as we talk about gullet share, I see sports drinks that are more healthy for you is the term. Better for you is the term, and so CBD infused beverages. You know, I mean, the reality is we have no idea what CBD really does. There's been insufficient studies to really figure it all out. But the view, the narrative is that it's healthy for you. So, you know, yeah,
it's plant based. That's right.
It's plant based. That's right. It's green.
It's very green.
I fully expect to see more and more CBD infused beverages out there and available. Right now, they have to go through dispensaries largely. But you know, as laws evolve, I think we'll see more and more CBD infused beverages, and that will compete for gullet share.
So, Rob McMillan, I really want to thank you for joining us on The Deep Dive. Where can people get a copy of this report if they want to read it?
Yeah, it's online. It's, Silicon Valley Bank's report, so it's really easy to find on svb.com. You just go online, svb.com, and look for the wine report, and you'll find it, along with video casts, if you really want to get into it, me and a panel and things that we've talked about with respect to the industry that are even deeper than your deeper dive.
Thank you. Well, that's going to do it for us today. We are always happy to hear from you and especially welcome your suggestions on future discussions, possible guests. Again, you can email us at deepdiveshow@winedownmedia.com, Twitter and Instagram at deepdiveshow, and I invite you to like us on Facebook, Deep Dive Show. I appreciate the help I get from Antonio DeWalk and all of my many friends here at KVON Napa. I want to thank you for joining us this week on The Deep Dive. I'm Larry Kamer, and we'll see you the next time.